Hello Bulls fans, and welcome to another episode of Bulls HQ. Thank you for joining me and hope you're all doing well out there in Bulls Nation. We're back for another show this week, and so is Zach LaVine making his long-awaited debut against the Detroit Pistons tonight. So we're recording this straight after the game, and to help me discuss LaVine's return, not only against the Pistons, but I guess moving forward in the second half of the season, I've got Kevin Ferrigan, host of the Nothing But Nylon podcast, joining me today to talk LaVine as well as those trade or Mirotić trade rumors that are circulating. So Kevin, thanks for joining me, mate.
Thanks for having me on. Always good to chat with you.
Might be the first time I've had you on Bulls HQ. Obviously, we talked in the Podman days, but is it the first time on Bulls HQ? It feels like it is.
I think so. I don't recall being on the new podcast. So I'm happy to make my debut. It feels like old times.
Good to have you on, and you're making your Bulls HQ debut, and Zach LaVine made his Bulls debut today. We just finished watching that game, and he had a good offensive performance, and I stress the offensive word because I know if I don't put that in, you're definitely going to pull me up on it.
as I did on Twitter.
Exactly.
He was about as expected on offense, and maybe even a little bit better than expected given the injury that he had. It's always dicey seeing guys come back from that, but he definitely looked like he had his bounce and his burst back. So that's definitely a good sign. He's not much of anything if he doesn't have those things. So definitely good that he was able to showcase that, and his shooting stroke looks as good as it did in his days in Minnesota. So those are the positives for sure.
Yeah, definitely. So that the Bulls definitely kept him under that minutes restriction, that 20-minute restriction that was going to be applied. So he only played the 19 minutes. But he had 14 points in those 19 minutes, making 5 of his 9 shots, 3 of his 4 threes, and looked very smooth out there from deep, running off screens and running into those threes. And like you said, looked very fluid out there from an athletic perspective. So obviously, we need to see a little bit more of him before we can sort of determine if he's fully back athletically. But I mean, from a straight line perspective, it certainly looks like that's the case. I want to see him laterally, how he's moving. But he did look really nice out there, and he still pops athletically out there on the court. So a very nice offensive performance, as we expected his defense. Well, he was never really a good defender, so we can't expect him in his first game back to be much on defense. But he got torched a little bit out there when he was on the court. But offensively, he looked really nice. And with Dunn and Markkanen next to him, those three together, at least in the first quarter, they really complemented each other well out there. Did you like their pairing initially on the court from what we saw today?
Yeah, I thought the initial group looked good. I mean, it helps when you make every shot that you take, which
the Bulls are doing.
Yeah, it was quite a hot start. Of course, they just about every shot the Pistons took, they also made. So there wasn't much of a they didn't get much benefit in terms of margin there. But the offense at least looked really good. I think it'll take, like you mentioned, LaVine has never been a good or even just regular bad defender. He's always been pretty terrible, but so it'll even if he was a good defender, it would take some time for him to integrate into a new system and get used to playing with a new set of guys and communicating with them and all of that sort of thing. You add to that that he's never been a very good defender at all. So it'll be interesting to see how that all shakes out.
Yeah, definitely. So I mean, the next 40 or so games for the Bulls will be really interesting just from that perspective alone, just seeing how Zach LaVine reintegrates into the NBA world, but also how he sort of figures to fit into this team. And I guess because we've only got 19 minutes of data to really have a look at Zach LaVine as a Bull, we don't really have much to go off. But even though he looked good today, what I wanted to do is really discuss LaVine from, I guess, his fit and his the way he will fit into this team going forward. So, but before we do that, and you've sort of alluded to it already, but I wanted to off the top rather set the table on how you feel about LaVine as a prospect. I have an idea of about what you're going to say, but I want you to let the listeners in on what you may see from Levine, or perhaps maybe even more importantly, what you don't see in Levine as a player.
Yeah, so I'm pretty, bearish, I guess I would say, on him as a prospect. He's definitely improved pretty much every season he's been in the league, which is to his credit. His scoring efficiency has improved every year. I think he's gotten better in terms of not turning the ball over every year. He's done that while basically maintaining his usage at a slightly above average clip, which is good. But the thing with Levine is he's part of this kind of archetype of guys that he does one thing really well, and really well is maybe even giving him a little bit too much credit. He's a pretty good scorer on decent volume, but he doesn't really make plays for other people. He's not like a big rebound guy. He is, a pretty terrible defensive player. So he's not really contributing in a lot of other aspects of the game. I don't necessarily want to say that he can't ever do any of those things. But he's been in the league now for 3 years, and you would think that we would start to see some of it. The flip side of it is that he's 21 years old, or he was 21 last year, 22 this season. And so... maybe there's more there. The athleticism is definitely there. I think one of the other things that's a little bit surprising about him, that based on his sort of athletic profile that you would probably think would be different, is that he doesn't really get to the foul line all that much for his career. He gets about 4.5 free throw attempts per 100 possessions, which is not really that great for a guy that with his sort of athletic gifts, and especially for a guy that scores about 25 points per 100 possessions, or 18 points per 36 minutes. You would think if he's doing that level of scoring that he would be getting to the line a lot more than he does, especially given that he's able to attack the basket. But he just he tends to coast a lot on the perimeter, and he has a really good jump shot. He's a very good shooter off the dribble, so you can kind of understand it a little bit. But if he's gonna take a leap, I think that's a big part of what he'll need to do, is to just be more aggressive. And I don't know if that's a personality thing, or if he doesn't necessarily have the wiggle on his dribble to get into the paint and really utilize that athleticism outside of transition. But yeah, I think that, he's a guy that has improved, so that's to his credit. I wouldn't completely write him off because of that. It's not like he is, Andrew Wiggins and spent, 3 years of his career not getting any better. And even Wiggins is now starting to see some improvement. It's always possible. When somebody is a guy that doesn't necessarily make plays for others and doesn't, contribute in a lot of other ways other than one way, that always makes me a bit skeptical about their prospects for real stardom, because that's sort of the thing that differentiates real stars from, points per game stars. So that's sort of how I feel about Zach LaVine.
Yeah, that's fair. I think most people would agree with that to an extent. Probably where some may differ is his ability to score, or what they see his top line being in terms of a scorer. I know some people out there have suggested that he may be able to be a 23 to 25 point per game type scorer, and I don't necessarily subscribe to that theory. But even if he is, like you said, he hasn't shown an ability to, I guess, get in there and rebound and create for others, and obviously play defense. So there's obviously there's value to a guy just being a great scorer, and if he's an efficient one, then that obviously is a positive as well. But yeah, like you said, we've yet to see the complete game from Levine, but obviously it's still early. He's 22 years old, and listening to the most recent Zach Lowe podcast where he had Jim Peterson on, the Timberwolves broadcast analyst on, he was raving about Levine in terms of his work ethic. So, and to your point, Levine has improved on each season. So I have some hope that he can improve in those areas to a degree, but like you sort of touched on, the main thing that I want to see him improve on is his free throw ability, or his ability to draw free throws. And why that is important going forward is not only for his game, but if you think about Chris Dunn and Lauri Markkanen as well, they're not necessarily two guys who really get to the line a lot. So if Levine, Markkanen and Dunn are going to be your three main offensive pieces going forward, which may be the case if the Bulls keep winning and find themselves with a less than desirable draft pick, then one of those three guys is going to really need to step up and get to the line a lot more. So that's what I want to see from Levine, and we'll see how that sort of progresses going forward. But I guess my main interest with Levine right now is how Fred Hoiberg is going to reintegrate him into the lineup, and I guess what the rotation will look like once Levine is fully back. So, like I said before, he's on a 20-minute restriction currently. He started the game today against the Pistons, but obviously played the 19 minutes. At least initially, how do you think Hoiberg is going to handle this reintegration process with Levine? He's obviously started that way by starting Levine in shooting guard and moving Valentine back to the bench. But by and large, how do you think he'll treat the rotation now that Levine is back?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. The initial look here was that, Zipser's basically out of the rotation, which, I mean, I think is the right move. Zipser's been pretty terrible for a little while now. And Valentine going to the bench makes sense to me. I'm really not a big Denzel Valentine fan. I find him very frustrating to watch, and he can't really get to the basket. We talked about this a little bit on Twitter, but he can't really get to the basket. Because he can't get to the basket, he's not as much of a threat. So he can't really create for others, which is a large part of his value when it came to his play in college. What made him like an intriguing prospect was that he was a good playmaker for other people. But he just has not been able to, because of his lack of athleticism and burst, and his inability to get into the paint consistently, he is not able to do much playmaking. And I think his defense is pretty bad. He doesn't really show up that much in some of the metrics. I don't think, I haven't looked at his defensive real plus minus or anything like that, but his, you know, defensive box plus minus, I think grades him out as pretty average, but that's not what I see when I watch him. He's really weak. He was getting muscled all over the place by Avery Bradley tonight. Bradley's a strong guy, but he's also not a huge guy, and he just pushed him all over the place, all over the floor. And you see that happen to Valentine a lot. He's I think you described him as skinny fat, which is pretty accurate. And
I meant that in the nicest way possible, by the way.
Hey, I mean, I've been skinny fat. It's fine, but it's not necessarily fine if you want to play rotation minutes for an NBA basketball team. I'm just not a very big fan of Valentine. So for me, I would rather see, his minutes get cut, and Nwaba not necessarily take a huge cut in the rotation. I guess I should say that in terms of if they're actually going to continue to try to win games, it would make more sense to me to do that. If they're trying to maximize the tank, then probably play Valentine over Nwaba, because I think Nwaba is just a better player than Valentine. He's much more athletic. He's able to get into the actually get easy baskets around the rim with his cutting and finish through contact. And he's a far superior defensive player to Valentine. I don't know what Fred's going to do, but that's what I would do, is to, the Levine minutes would come at the expense of Valentine and Zipser for me.
Yeah, and like you said, Zipser's obviously out of the rotation. And looking at the minutes, the way Fred distributed his minutes in this game against the Pistons, he had Valentine with 21 minutes, even though Valentine was the first guard off the bench. He only played the 21 minutes compared to David Nwaba, who had the 26, and Justin Holiday starting alongside Levine had the 32. So the distribution there on the wings was pretty good, I think, at this point. Once once they start ramping up Levine's minutes from, say, 19 upwards to like 25 or 30, I guess that's when it's going to be really interesting of Valentine, Nwaba and Holiday, who loses minutes. It might be a combination of all three. You know, I've definitely made it very clear on Twitter as well as on Bulls HQ that I would be making Valentine my fourth guard in the rotation. I think there's no way Nwaba should be losing minutes or playing anything less than 25 minutes a game, assuming, again, that the Bulls actually want to win games. Like you said, I think Nwaba needs to stay in the rotation. But I guess one of the interesting points that's being discussed on Bulls Twitter as well is about who you would start next to Zach LaVine in the starting lineup. So would you personally start Justin Holiday or David Nwaba at small forward?
So it's a tough question, right? Because if you start Nwaba, then you have basically Chris Dunn and Nwaba in the backcourt, which is not great from a floor spacing perspective. But, you know, Nwaba, I think, is a much better defensive player than Justin Holiday. You know, it's kind of which end are you trying to optimize for, I guess, to some extent, because Nwaba is going to give you a lot better defense, and he's not going to space the floor, and you're going to face a real constriction on, you know, floor spacing with him and Chris Dunn together. You know, Dunn has looked better on his shot. I was saying this tonight. He looks really great as a shooter if he has his feet underneath of him. The problem is a lot of the time he doesn't get his feet set, and he, you know, when he doesn't take his time or doesn't, you know, get his feet directly underneath of him, he looks terrible. But when he does, his jumper looks nice. The problem is just the consistency with Dunn, which has been the case pretty much his whole career so far. But, you know, I think I would probably start Holiday. I don't think he's a terrible defender. I just don't think he's as good a defender as Nwaba. But in terms of balance, you know, he can still shoot the three. He's, you know, a passable defender. And Chris Dunn is, you know, an incredible defender. So I think that between the two of them, you have pretty good backcourt defense. Levine's going to be, you know, not great there. But, you know, with Lopez, Dunn, and Holiday, I think you have enough defense to be, you know, passable with the starters. Whereas, you know, with Nwaba, the defense would be probably a little bit better, but your offense would struggle, which can have a negative effect on your defense too if you're not able to score the ball.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I would start Holiday for balance reasons and you know, politically as well. He's obviously, I won't say a marquee free agent signing, but he was probably the biggest free agent the Bulls signed, and he's one of the team leaders, I guess. So it would be hard to remove him from the starting lineup. From a political perspective, I guess. So Holiday making a starting at small forward does make sense. And I kind of like Nwaba being that piece off the bench that just comes in and just starts wrecking everyone as this high energy guy off the bench. So I'm kind of liking it at the moment. The one thing I didn't want to see is Valentine and Levine playing together. But unfortunately, we saw about 2 minutes of that tonight. So I'm hoping that doesn't trend forward. Oh, it isn't a trend moving forward, but having said that, if that can help sustain the tank, then maybe we need to play these two guys heavy minutes together.
Yeah, those two together is a train wreck defensively. I see only bad things with those two playing together. You know, Levine, I think, has the physical tools to be a pretty decent defensive player. I don't know if it's a mental thing with him or if it's an effort thing, or I'm, you know, just having watched him, you know, in the 19 minutes he played tonight, a lot of his mistakes look to be mental, but that could also just be a product of being in a new system with new teammates and all that sort of thing. You know, I know that he was a poor defender in Minnesota, but I don't necessarily remember specifically whether it was, you know, more down to attitude versus, you know, mental capability when it comes to that. Because a lot of the times it's hard to separate those two things out.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. So, I mean, we'll see how that progresses throughout the season. But So far, I was pretty pleased with how Højbjerg had managed his rotations during the whole season. But even in this game, even though I didn't necessarily like the Valentine and Levine combination, I think by and large, Højbjerg manages pretty well, and he kept Levine under 20 minutes. So John Paxson, I'm sure, would be very happy with that as well. He won't be stressing about having to go down and have a word to his coach about minutes restrictions. I'm sure he's happy about that. But look, the reason why I wanted to have you on this podcast is because of your analytical approach to, I guess, analyzing the game just generally. But given that I want to talk about Levine and later Mirotić, two guys that I guess, again, amongst Bulls Twitter have been an interesting discussion pieces from an analytics perspective. What I wanted to really start talking about now is about Levine and how he could actually help the Bulls tank. Now, I've seen online you sort of project that, you know, playing Levine and the way the rotation may settle out, that it may actually help the Bulls tank. I sort of know what you were talking about there, but are you able to expand on that and sort of just let everyone know what your basic thinking was behind that point?
Yeah, so the way that the Bulls, to the extent that they've been winning, is their defense is better than their offense. You know, they're 29th in the league right now in offensive rating, and were 23rd in defensive rating. Now that might change after tonight's game because they played pretty terribly on defense tonight. But you know, I don't think that Levine is going to markedly improve the offense. I think the offense will get a little bit better, but I think that he's going to take one of the, you know, their relative strengths of the defense and probably make it worse. You know, maybe that's not the case if his minutes just come at the expense of Zipser and Valentine, both of whom have not been very effective defensive players. I know a lot of people kind of thought of Zipser as being a solid defender, but the numbers really don't bear that out. And Valentine, his, you know, sort of metrics are kind of a mixed bag on defense, but I personally find him to be pretty unsightly defender. So if, you know, if all of his minutes are coming at the expense of those guys, maybe it doesn't have as drastic of an effect as I was kind of joking. But my thought was that his minutes were going to come at the expense of Nwaba, just because Nwaba is kind of like the guy that they signed as a flyer, and you know, doesn't necessarily have the same sort of cachet in the league. And so that was kind of my assumption. And if I think Nwaba is been a big part of why the Bulls have been successful. You know, he kind of arrived at the same time as Mirotić coming back. He came back from his injury as well. And, you know, I think the combination of those two has been a big part of why they've been better. And if Levine was going to take his minutes, I thought it was going to be a huge drop off in defense. You're going from a very solid defensive player to, you know, statistically one of the worst defensive players in the league the last few years. So that was kind of where my head was at with that.
Yeah, and I mean, logically speaking, that makes complete sense. And to support your point, in his three seasons to date, from an on-off perspective, Levine has been, I guess, a negative player from a net rating perspective. So now, obviously, different situation, different context, all these sorts of things. But it goes to your point that Levine obviously can provide something offensively, but there is because he's a large negative on defense, the net effect is that he's not necessarily helping your team. And that was the case in his three seasons in Minnesota, or his 2.5 seasons, I guess, given the injury. But obviously, like I said, different context here now that he's part of a Bulls team, a bad Bulls team, but we'll see how that sort of translate going forward. But given that he was such a negative in those advanced statistical categories with the Wolves, how much should that really be factored into his, I guess, his next role here with the Chicago, given the fact that there's such dramatic changes between the scenarios, not only from, I guess, the players he's playing with, but the fact that a team like the Wolves were actually a really good offense last season, whereas the Bulls are shockingly bad.
Yeah, so it's a good point you're making about the context and taking that into account for any of these metrics, even the on off stuff, and even like the adjusted, you know, sort of the real plus minus and you know, the adjusted plus minus family of metrics. I think, you know, the context still plays a role, because you can't really separate that out from what's happening. Like, you see it all the time where guys will switch teams and, you know, all of a sudden their numbers, and even just like if you take away the numbers and just look at their adjusted plus minus metrics, they, you know, the change in role completely changes how they perform. You know, I think like a great example of that is Matt Bonner was always like one of these like great on off guys, and great even like when you did the adjustment for you did the like adjusted plus minus stuff, he would always stand out as being really great. And it was because, you know, Coach Popovich did a great job of maximizing his skill set. And so he would always look like this world beater in terms of his impact on the margin of the game. You know, if you put Matt Bonner on a team with a lesser coach, he would look a lot worse. He's a limited player. So yeah, I mean, that stuff is all important to keep in mind when you're talking about these things. I think that, you know, LaVine had 2.5 seasons of data. I think his college metrics also indicated a player that, you know, would be probably able to score in the league, but not necessarily have a great impact. And then, you know, if he has similar numbers in a different context here with the Bulls, you know, I think you have to go based on, you know, the best way that we have to project the future is to look to the past, right? Like, it's imperfect, and a lot of the times there's things that happen that you can't necessarily foresee, but in general, it works pretty well. So, you know, if he's not able to show, and again, he's shown improvement, you know, maybe not so much in terms of like the impact stats, the adjusted plus minus type stats, but, you know, in terms of his scoring efficiency and things of that nature, he's definitely improved his skill level, and his, you know, that stuff does matter. I just think that if he's unable to really sort of change that narrative, I would be very sort of reticent to invest a ton of money in him. But they also, he's like the main piece that they got for Jimmy Butler, or at least that's sort of how he's been presented. You know, I think Chris Dunn has done a good job of, you know, making it more of a an even split. And then, you know, Lauri Markkanen has had a very solid rookie year. So he's not the only piece, but I think that the Bulls are kind of in a tough spot where he's one of the main things that they got for, you know, a guy who's now playing like the best player in the league, or, you know, one of them.
Yeah, 100%. And at the time of the deal, LaVine was the centerpiece of the deal because Dunn had come off a bad rookie season. And at the time, the seventh pick was just the seventh pick. He wasn't Lauri Markkanen or this version of Lauri Markkanen that we've seen. So LaVine still is central to this Butler deal. Obviously, it's the rise of Lauri Markkanen and the improvement of Dunn has helped mitigate, I guess, the need for him to become a star or something of that nature. But he's still a big piece in this deal. But I guess why I ask that question is because I'm pretty much expecting LaVine, the fact that he's returning from an ACL, he's going to be the lead offensive option on a really bad team that generally will have, I guess, will perform poorly in advanced metrics. I just wonder what the narrative will be around LaVine, given all that context, as well as how bad this team will be, if he happens to post a really bad BPM, or his on-off splits just an ineffective or not necessarily an influential player, how that will affect the perception of him moving forward. So you sort of touched on how you think that will play out. So I won't necessarily ask you that question, but that to me, I think, is going to be something that's going to be really interesting to see over the next 40 games, is how the narrative around LaVine will be sort of structured based on his advanced metrics. But he's going to be an interesting case of applying that versus what we see on the court from an eye test perspective and moving forward. But I guess thinking about what he can produce on the court, how do you think, or where do you see over the next 40 games or so, where do you think his value will lie from a contract perspective?
Well, so it's his value, where his value will lie and where his contract will end up might be different things. But, you know, like I said, I would be hesitant to offer him a ton of money. You know, if he's going to get $15 million a year, that I think that seems probably, you know, I would consider that be overpaying a little bit. But, you know, I think the market for him is going to be such that they're probably going to have to overpay, because teams still to this day, even with the sort of being in the, I guess, data ball is one of the ways that people are describing it. Being in this era of more data and more information, teams still consistently overpay for scorers. And who knows? Maybe it's not that it's not really overpaying. Maybe they know something that I don't about what's valuable. But I think that teams are willing to gamble, I guess, on guys that they know can get buckets, even if they haven't necessarily shown the other aspects of the game. They think that they can. That stuff is developable. I think that, you know, it is to some degree, but I think it might be that might be a little bit overstated in the minds of some of these teams. But you know, if they get him for like, you know, 4 years, $60 million, that would be not the worst, because I think like that's like probably average starter money. And I don't think he's like, you know, he's not an average starter at this point. Or hasn't been to this point in his career, but he, you know, so you're paying a little bit for some improvement, but I'm sure he's going to be looking for more money than that.
Yeah, I 100% assume that's the case. So his max will be around the $25 million mark, depending on where, I guess, the cap initially gets set, depending on what that final number will be. But just for the sake of this conversation, we'll call it around $25 million or so, at least in that first season. So if that's his max contract, that's definitely what he'll be chasing. So, and that's going to be one of the storylines that, I guess, surrounds this team moving forward, is over the next 40 games or so, is how much time he gets to really, I guess, showcase himself as a lead guy worthy of that max. But you mentioned $15 million there. I think that would be fantastic from a cap perspective. But I think for me at least, if the Bulls can get him under 4 years, $80 million, knowing that you generally have to overpay to keep guys and those sorts of things, I think that would be a win for the Bulls. Assuming he can at least be the player he was last season, if he can return to being that player, that would be nice. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see, because the thing that may really work in the Bulls' favor here is the fact that there's not a lot of teams out there with cap space. And I know LaVine does a lot of things that the league likes or is enjoying at the moment from, you know, a shooting perspective at least. I still think there's not going to be necessarily a huge market out there for a guy that, like you said, like we've talked about all his flaws, and he's only coming back 30 to 40 games into the season now. I don't know if the value is necessarily going to be there for him for a max deal. So hopefully the Bulls can lock him up to a deal not exceeding, you know, $80 million over 4 years or something like that. But if they could get him for something closer to $15 million per season, that would be incredible. But I probably don't see that happening. I think it's going to be closer to $20 million myself.
Yeah, and I think that $20 million is probably reasonable to expect from a market perspective. I think $20 million for, in terms of what you're actually getting on the floor, and what you're likely to get over those 4 years, is, you know, a pretty massive overpay. But, you know, sometimes that's just what the market is. And, you know, you can make the argument that if that's what the market is, then you should just walk away. But you also have to roll out a roster, right? And the Bulls, I don't think, are interested in a multiple year tank job. I will say though that it would be pretty rich if they ended up signing him to, you know, $20 million a year, and it was largely driven by the fact that they allegedly didn't want to pay Jimmy Butler his next contract, and then they go out and pay Zach LaVine, you know, $20 million a year. So that would be kind of ironic to me, or, you know, maybe not even ironic is the right word, maybe just dumb. But yeah, I'm not really sure where he'll end up in terms of money, but he's going to be a really interesting case. I do think, to your point, that it does work to the Bulls' advantage that, you know, he's going to be a free agent in a year where there's not going to be a lot of free cap space available. And he has been a pretty limited player in terms of impact. They always say that all it takes is one asshole. And so, you know, who knows what's out there in terms of what teams might be willing to do. There could be a team that's out there that, like the Nets did to Portland a while ago, goes out and gives him a massive offer, like what happened with Allen Crabbe. So, you know, you never know, I guess.
Yeah, and I hope that doesn't happen. Hopefully none of those shenanigans take place. But, I mean, the Bulls really have three major decisions heading into the offseason, one of them being around LaVine and his contract situation. Another would be what they do with their remaining cap space and whether they try to, you know, lure a big name or whether they overpay for some decent role players and sort of fill up their cap that way. And the other obvious big decision will be what they do with their draft picks. So they're the main things heading into the offseason. But I guess their biggest roster move that they need to really manage moving forward is how they handle Nikola Mirotic. So trending off or moving away from Zach LaVine, I wanted to focus now on Nikola Mirotic, who, apart from LaVine, is probably the biggest story thus far of the Bulls season. Obviously, what happened in the offseason, how he's come back and how he's played, and obviously now the trade rumors that are circulating. And we're pretty much only a day or two away from when Mirotic can be officially traded. Hopefully this podcast won't be timestamped to a degree, because I'm planning on releasing this on Monday morning. Hopefully he's not traded at this point or that time, making this next 20 minutes or so somewhat redundant. But obviously the Mirotic trade talks are going to start heating up once Jan 15 rolls around, because that is when Mirotic can be traded. So news broke pretty much last week that Mirotic has an interest in playing in Utah and playing for Quinn Snyder, which to me makes complete sense. So that was, I guess, broken by Woj there, as well as I think Joe Cowley had some news on that as well. And then the rumors started flying thereafter, with Mark Stein reporting that the Pistons were interested, and I think Casey Johnson chimed in on the back there with the Portland Trail Blazers also being interested in Mirotic as well. So my first question to you around that is, what did you make of that news? And from those teams' perspective, why does it make sense for Mirotic, or for them to be chasing Mirotic?
I think it makes sense that there are teams that are interested in Mirotic. I mean, he especially of late has, you know, I think it, you know, I think he's been basically this good for a while. But, you know, sometimes it takes a good narrative for people's perceptions of a player to catch up with what the reality of that player is. And, you know, the Bulls being one of the worst teams in the league, and then Mirotic comes back and they start winning a bunch of games. You know, that it leads to a pretty clean narrative about causality, which I think, you know, perked up some teams that, you know, that every team in the league had an opportunity. Well, every team with cap space had an opportunity to throw him an offer sheet, this summer, and none of them did. So, you know, I think that his value around the league seems to be up, and it's probably closer to where I think it always should have been. I've always been pretty high on him as in terms of what relative to, I guess, the general consensus about him, particularly among Bulls fans. A lot of people don't seem to like Nico all that much. I think probably just because his shooting is pretty volatile, and people don't really have a lot of patience for that. Even though he's, unlike a lot of guys that can be a scorer, he contributes in a lot of other ways. I think that people just look at him and don't necessarily see a guy that is pretty good at getting steals for a big man, and like has some switchy defensive versatility in terms of being able to switch on the guards and you know, is a good playmaker if you give him the ball and ask him to you know, run some pick and roll or things like that. Like, he has a lot to his game, and I don't even think that the Bulls fully unleashed him in his time in Chicago. Even in this winning streak, I think, like, he hasn't necessarily been asked to do as much as I think he's capable of. But in any event, I'm not surprised that there are teams that are out there interested in him. I'm not surprised that, you know, the Jazz are interested. They are a pretty smart front office. Typically, they seem to be pretty good at talent evaluation. The Pistons, they've had a hit or miss record for talent evaluation. Same for the Blazers, but, you know, that's most teams. But I could see him fitting on any of those teams, really. It would be, you know, I think all three of those teams have good coaches. I think Quinn Snyder is a good coach. I think Stan Van Gundy is a very good coach. And I think Terry Stotts, you know, runs some really nice actions and would probably, you know, have some fun stuff to put Nico in. And, you know, they could really use the shooting. In Portland, they, you know, I think they have people kind of think about them as being a team with shooting just because they have Dame and CJ McCollum. But outside of those two guys, they really struggle to make shots. Losing Alan Crabb was, you know, one of their only other shot makers. And so they're, you know, they're a little bit bereft of shooting. And I think he would really help them because of that.
Yeah, look, I 100% agree with you, and I wrote a post up there on Bulls HQ this week pretty much alluding to the fact that these are three teams that want to be a high three-point shooting team, and given that Mirotić at the moment is shooting 46.5% from three, and pretty much amongst front-court players that have played 400 or more minutes, he's second to only Davis Pertans in terms of volume of threes taken in per 100 possessions. So when you combine all that and what Mirotić is producing this season, it really is a weapon from the three-point line. And the Utah Jazz are one of the, I guess, one of the better three-point shooting teams in the league from a percentage perspective, but also in terms of the number of field goal attempts they take from three relative from their total field goal attempts. But the Pistons and the Blazers aren't that, to your point that you were making, particularly around the Blazers. They were a team that really relied on that three-point shot, at least in prior years under Terry Stotts. And Stotts is certainly someone that wants to have a high percentage of his shots being from the three-point line, but that hasn't been the case this season. So just thinking about it logically, that's why Mirotić to Portland as well as Detroit, again, a team that wants to shoot a lot of threes but doesn't necessarily get a lot of their offense from there. That's why they're really interested in Mirotić, and those three teams could really use a stretch four. They don't necessarily have one at the moment. So I'm not surprised to see these three teams making a call for Mirotić, but from a Chicago's perspective, which of those teams do you think could produce the best return for Mirotić?
Yeah, that's a tough question because I guess I'm not as steeped in knowing what sort of draft assets any of those teams have. I don't think that the Bulls are necessarily interested in getting players back from Mirotić. You know, one of the advantages besides getting a pick, one of the other sort of benefits to getting rid of Mirotić is that that should help them with their increasing the value of their own pick by assisting their tank. Because right now he's been, you know, they've won a bunch of close games. And I think, you know, if you remove one of their two or three best players during that stretch, that's the difference between winning and losing. And they really need to start losing more. But as far as what's available from those teams, I guess I'd have to look more closely at what assets they have in terms of draft assets. I think right now either the Jazz or Portland are in the worst shape as far as their own pick, right? So, yeah.
So Utah currently have a losing record, so they would hold the 11th pick if the draft was to be held today, assuming positions were to stay as is.
Yeah, so, I mean, from that perspective, Utah is probably the best bet. I also think that they have... you know, I think Mirotić would improve them. I think he would be actually a nice fit with a front court of Mirotić and Epe Udo would be pretty nice. Udo is a really good rim protector, but not much of a scorer outside of like maybe some stuff around the basket. And obviously, we know what Mirotić can do in terms of spacing the floor and all that sort of thing. I think that, you know, obviously, I think their record would get better with him. So it might push them back into the playoffs and outside of the lottery. But I think that he's going to improve whatever team he goes to. So if you're sending him to the worst of those teams, that's probably for the best. And I think I know Derek Favors was rumored as sort of part of the deal, and I think he's an expiring contract, so I don't think that the Bulls would be interested in bringing him back. I think if he's just salary filler, that's probably pretty good. I just don't know what you do with Favors in terms of playing time and things like that, because he's kind of one of those guys that is, if you play him, he's too good that to the point where he's going to hurt your ability to tank. So that's, and he's, you know, where he is in a contract year, I think it would be very politically problematic to not play him and just kind of ask him to sit it out the rest of the year. So who knows if there, if there's actually discussions around Favors, maybe the Bulls are actually interested in him sort of as a prospect. I think he's a real tough fit next to Gobert. So it makes sense that they'd be looking to include him as part of a package for somebody that maybe fits a little bit better.
Yeah, and I've floated the idea as well in a mailbag post that I made, that Favors or the Jazz sending back Favors to the Bulls makes sense for them, because I guess they've tried to make this pairing of Favors and Gobert work before, and they're probably ready to move on. And the fact that Favors is a free agent, whereas Mirotić, assuming that team option is opted into, can have another year remaining on his deal, they wouldn't necessarily lose their power forward or their starting power forward for nothing, I guess, like they did with obviously Gordon Hayward in the offseason. So right. It wouldn't surprise me if they would try to, I guess, recoup their power forward position rather by including Favors. And the fact that Favors pretty much earns the exact same amount as Mirotić makes sense from a salary perspective. And the Jazz are a team that are operating over the cap, I believe. So they need to almost match salaries to a degree. So that makes sense to me. But like you said, Favors is still a good player. He has value. And including a pick with Favors, like the 11th pick that it currently is now, is probably not going to happen unless the Bulls, or I guess unless the Jazz put on some sort of heavy protections on that pick, or unless maybe the Bulls send something back towards Utah. So it'll be interesting how that plays out itself. But the Detroit Pistons own the 20th pick at the moment, and the Portland Trailblazers have the 17th pick at the moment. So they're interesting first rounders that the Bulls could hopefully get back for Mirotić, something in the mid first round there. But pretty much what the Bulls want for Mirotić is a first-round pick and no long-term bad contract. So that's what's been reported. And I don't think they can have both. If they want a pick, they need to take on some bad salary, I guess. Maybe something that doesn't last for 3 or 4 seasons, but maybe something that lasts maybe 1 or 2 seasons. So I'm thinking like a Myers Leonard or maybe even an Evan Turner. Obviously, two seasons of their deals have been absorbed already. You would still have to pay 2 of those years going forward. But if you want that pick, that extra first rounder, I don't think you're going to get that just from Mirotić and having no salary attached to that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I get, you know, I'm all for them being as greedy as possible at the outset and not negotiating against themselves, because Lord knows they've, you know, done really poorly in some trades. You know, I think some of the second rounders that they seem to just toss in as, you know, you want another second rounder? Here you go. Here's like 3 of them. That seems to be Gar's MO. He'll just, you know, toss extra assets at you for no reason. I think that if they're at least being pretty strong on that for now, that's probably good. But I think if it comes down to, you know, not making a deal or you know, passing up the opportunity to get a first round pick for Mirotić, I think you got to take the extra year or two of salary, just because I think you know, they're not going to be good anytime soon. This is the first year of the rebuild, and you know, I don't see any can't miss you know, star on the roster. I really like Lauri Markkanen. I think Chris Dunn has shown some flashes. I already talked about how I feel about Zach LaVine. There's no one on this roster that seems to be like, yeah, that guy is going to be a future all-NBA player that we should feel good about. So they need to be getting as many bites at the apple at grabbing a player like that as they can. And their best bet to do that is through the draft. So if you have to eat some bad salary when you're not going to be a good team anyway, in order to get another draft asset, I think you have to do it. You know, the odds of drafting an all-NBA player from the late lottery or mid-first round is pretty low, but, you know, pretty low is better than zero, right? So the more just chances you have, the better off you are. And it is a fairly deep draft. Maybe there will be some gems later in the draft. We know it's, you know, all the talk is that it's really it's really deep at the top. So, you know, maybe that trickles down to the mid and late first round. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think you can't get too caught up on, oh, we got to keep our cap sheet clean, because honestly, who's signing in Chicago right now with what their roster looks like? Probably nobody. So, you know, I think the value of their cap space is pretty low right now.
Yeah, exactly. I agree 100%. And if you look at the Blazers and the Detroit Pistons, if you look at their cap sheet, there really is no way to make a trade without them sending back a guy that's going to have a bad contract back to Chicago. That has to happen. So from a Portland perspective, you've got Evan Turner and Myers Leonard, who I mentioned before. You maybe even got Mo Harkless as well. Those three guys have 2 years remaining after this season, varying amounts between them. Evan Turner around $18 million next season, whereas Harkless and Leonard are closer to the $11 million mark. But there's no way that Portland are going to engineer a trade with Chicago without one of those guys coming back. So the Bulls would have to accept a contract of that nature if they want that first round pick. Same thing with Detroit. I mean, they're a team that's going to have over $100 million committed next season, which is the same for Portland. And there's no real way to engineer a trade between the Pistons and the Bulls without someone like John Lua coming back to Chicago. And Lua is a guy that's making about $20 million over the next two seasons. But he has to be included from a salary matching perspective for the Bulls to make out from this trade with the first round pick in hand. So whilst I understand that they want a first round pick and no bad salaries for Mirotić, and that's, you know, very nice of them to ask for that, then the reality is they're not going to get that. They have to take on someone like John Lua if they want to get the Pistons' first round pick.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, if they were able to take on John Lua's salary, I don't think John Lua is like a terrible player. I actually, you know, liked him a long time ago when it was draft season. I thought he would be like a decent, like, late round player. And, you know, he's lasted quite a while in the league, and he's making $10.5 million a year now. So, he's had a decent career for a guy that was drafted pretty late. He's got some floor stretchability. He's a rotation guy. He's definitely way overpaid for what he is, but you know, he's not like completely dead salary, I don't think. His PER sucks, but I think he's better than that indicates. I don't think he's worth $10.5 million a year. But I also don't think that he's like a completely useless player. So, but he's also not so good that he's gonna, help or change the Bulls' fortunes in terms of a tank. He's not gonna do that. His PR this year is really bad, but that's based on like an 8-game sample. So, traditionally, like, his numbers, have been decent. Like, he last year he played him like 1900 minutes, and his box plus minus was a 0.1, so it was like basically right at league average. So, you know, he's not a terrible player. And, you know, he's 28 now, so you'd be paying him until he was 30, I guess. But, you know, it's a pretty small price to pay to get another crack at a first round pick in what should be a pretty good draft. So, you know, it's not going to be a high draft pick in all likelihood, but it's not the worst thing in the world to take on a little bit of bad salary, and to especially to help ensure that your own pick is going to be better, because right now they keep winning, and it's a problem.
It's definitely a problem, and Mirotić is one of those reasons, and I guess that's why they need to move him straight away or as soon as possible. So let's see if they do that pretty much on Jan 15. I would assume they're not going to, given that they played him against the Pistons today. So Mirotić was missed a few games due to illness, but he returned today against the Pistons along with Levine. And I guess if they had a trade lined up for Mirotić, they probably would have held him out, given that this was the last game before Jan 15, or before the day he's eligible to be moved. So I would assume he's not going to be moved on Jan 15. Hopefully it's not too much longer after. But similar question to that I posed to you about Zach LaVine before, in terms of what his impact will be on the tank. And Mirotić, I guess, is the complete opposite to Zach LaVine in the sense that he's always really projected well from an on-off numbers perspective. His splits there have always been really good from a net rating perspective this season. I think apart from David Dwaba, he's the only Bull with a positive net rating when he's on the floor. Everyone else is in a minus, I believe, off the top of my head. So Mirotić has been super impactful this season. So my question to you is, if you remove Mirotić out of the lineup, and like we sort of were talking about LaVine before, even with LaVine coming back, how much do you think that really impact the Bulls?
Yeah, I mean, I think Mirotić is probably... I would probably say he's the Bulls' best player this year. You know, you could make a case that the best player has been like Justin Holiday, or some people might even say like Robin Lopez, just because he's been so steady inside. But I would say it's probably been Nico. I mean, granted, he hasn't had to play as many minutes as everybody else. You know, he got punched in the face. So, but... you know, I think he's really good, and he's been a huge reason why, you know, why they've been winning games. And I think I alluded to this earlier, that like a lot of these games they're winning, they're not winning by very much. And, you know, if they can stop winning those squeakers, which I think, you know, you take somebody that's, you know, consistently a plus one, two, three player over 100 possessions, depending on whatever metric you might be looking at, and you replace him with more minutes for, I don't know, Paul Zipser or Zach LaVine or whoever, that, you know, typically grades out as a slight negative in the case of LaVine, or depending on what number you're looking at. Some of the plus minus metrics really think LaVine is a pretty negative player. But like Zipser has like been grading out as like one of the worst players in the league. If you get rid of Mirotić and you get more minutes to Zipser, the Bulls are going to be a lot worse. And so that's, you know, that's the hope, I guess, is that it helps them get to where they need to be in terms of tanking.
Yeah, and I mean, at the time of recording this, the Bulls currently sit ninth in the tankathon ratings, or standings rather. So I guess from a wing perspective, they're at 16, where teams like Atlanta and Sacramento and even Orlando are more closer to 11 or 12 or 13, in that range. So I guess there is plenty of time here for the Bulls to realign this tank and get it back on the rails and get it sorted if they can move someone like Mirotić. And given that, you know, he, like I mentioned, that he's pretty much the only player that has a positive net rating, and Mirotić, you know, throughout his career has always been someone that has strongly or performed strongly in those sort of advanced metrics. It does stand to reason that if you replace him with inferior players, like I guess LaVine can be from a net rating perspective, on off splits numbers and those sorts of things, and like Paul Zipser, maybe he comes back into the rotation after you move Mirotić and he plays more of a backup power forward, then that will have a pretty big impact for the Bulls, and potentially they could re-enter that race for a top 3 to 5 pick, and that could be huge for the franchise going forward. So We'll see what happens. We'll see if this trade happens this week. I'm hoping it happens as quick as possible. I don't know if it's going to happen right on Jan 15, but I'd be very surprised if we're waiting until the trade deadline to make this move. But hopefully next podcast I record, Mirotić has been traded, but we'll see. So, but look, I appreciate you jumping online here and talking to me about LaVine and Mirotić. It's going to be an interesting remaining 40 games for the Bulls from a LaVine perspective, but the next couple of weeks from what they do with Mirotić should also be pretty fascinating as well. So thanks for joining me. Tell everyone where they can follow you online.
Yeah, you can follow me on NBA Couchside on Twitter. If I write anything, I typically link to it. Either write it on my site at NBACouchside.com, or I will usually, if I write somewhere else, I'll usually throw a link to it. My account is locked right now on Twitter, but you can still try to follow me, and I have typically been letting people follow me, but I just went incognito a little bit online for some, you know, personal reasons, I guess. But you know, you can still follow me. I'll probably accept your request as long as your account doesn't look sketchy. So
fair enough. I mean, that's fair enough. And I probably should have asked you this before, but given that you're on a Bulls based podcast, I should say, and that you were a former Bulls fan. What would it take you to get you back on the big red bus that my friend CBE Fred is referring to this thing as? Would it take someone like a Luka Doncic to get you back on board if for some reason come next June, or in June I should say, he's holding a Bulls cap and he's shaking the hand of Adam Silver up there on the podium, and he's wearing a Bulls hat as the first overall pick? Are you going to be back on board?
Well, I think I said, I don't know where I said it. It might have just been Twitter, but when I was first sort of dealing with my crisis of fandom, I guess you could call it, I latched on to Luka and said at one point that I was just going to root for wherever he went. So I guess technically if he goes to the Bulls, then I'm stuck back on the bus. but
reluctantly.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's one of those things where if you have bad management, which, you know, maybe the Bulls are proving me wrong on this, the trade I think still looks bad, but I think it looks better than it did at the time. But they've made a lot of really bad trades under Gar Forman. I think they were a little bit better run when Paxson was a GM. I don't think he was a great GM, but I don't think he was bad. And I think Gar Forman has been affirmatively bad as a GM. And so when you have that management, it just becomes very discouraging because you can't win with bad management in pro sports. So that is my reluctance, I guess, to get back on board. The Bulls do have some fun players. I think Chris Dunn is a very frustrating player to watch, but he can be very fun, especially watching him on defense is a lot of fun. And Lauri Markkanen is obviously very fun. You know, Nico was kind of like the last of the players that I really cared about of the prior crop of Bulls players, and so I thought I would be for sure out once he finally got traded. But of course, I had to go and trade for two guys that I kind of like, and then, you know, of course, David Nwaba is you know, hard not to root for. So
yeah, so what I'm hearing from there is you're pretty much back. So. Here's to hoping that Luka Doncic becomes a Bull for your sake and for mine, because he's my guy in the draft as well. But
yeah, he's incredible. We shall see what happens. He's incredible.
He's awesome. He's awesome.
Completely dominating the EuroLeague as a, what is he, 18, 19 years old? It's absurd. He should not, no one should be that good at that age, but he is.
He is, and yeah, we'll see what happens. But look, like I said before, I appreciate you you're coming on, and maybe once Doncic is a Bull, you can, you know, jump back on and we can start parading around and talking about how this is the next title team.
Yeah, well, they got to start losing. They got to start losing, or it's not going to happen.
Yeah, well,
he's probably right. Going number one overall, if not number one, probably like two or three. So they got to deal Nico, and they got to start losing.
Well, the draft's back in Chicago this season. Maybe you know, something similar to what happened in 2008 can happen again. It's the 10-year anniversary, I guess, of that 1.7% chance turning into Derrick Rose. So,
there you go.
Let's speak that into existence, Bulls fans. So we'll see what
happens.
Speaking
into existence, LeVar Ball style.
Exactly, exactly. But thanks again for joining me, Kev. I really appreciate it, mate.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Cool. So I'll be back again next week, hopefully with some more news about Mirotić. Well, hopefully, as we just sort of talked about then, that he has been traded and the Bulls can right this tank. But I'll catch you all again next week.